We're dealing with the modern state of Israel and Bible prophecy. The question we're asking is the modern state found in Bible prophecy? And on this question of whether it is or is not a fulfillment of Bible prophecy, there are basically five different perspectives. Now, we'll discuss the first three in the introduction. We'll deal with the fourth one a bit later on the outline, if you have the outline at the bottom of the first page. And then they present the option I'm giving will be the fifth perspective. Now, the first perspective is the perspective of replacement theology. And these were inaugurated specifically by two men. One is Origen, who introduced the allegorical interpretation of Scripture. He applied them more in the Bible in general. It was really important. It was not so much the obvious lower meaning, but the deeper spiritual meaning. And then Augustine took those principles and then applied them specifically to Bible prophecy, and he basically invented, although there were seeds of it already, he basically invented a millennialism. And in the City of God book, he propagated that view. And therefore, although the church was primarily premillennial, he began to make a major turn. And therefore, the 1,000 years of Revelation is not really time between the little 1,000 years following the Second Coming. Rather, it's the symbolic period between the First and Second Coming. So we are now in the Messianic Kingdom. This is the millennium. And coming from a Jewish perspective, I would say if this is the millennium, we must be living in the slum section of the millennium. It's not as nice as God said it would be in the Scriptures. And therefore, the modern Jewish state does not fulfill any biblical prophecy. It's merely an accident of history. And they see no future for ethnic Israel as such. The second view disagrees with the first one. They do believe that there will be a final restoration of Israel. But look at the modern Jewish state that does not fit many of the prophecies that people look at. So again, they disagree with the first view. There will eventually be a final restoration of the Jewish people in all of the promised land. But they fail to see the modern Jewish state fulfilling any such prophecy. And therefore, they do agree with the first view that as far as the present state of Israel, it's merely an accident of history. J. Vernon McGee, for example, the pastor of the Church of the Open Door in Los Angeles, a very solid dispensationalist, actually himself took that specific view. Now, some of the scriptures that have trouble with are listed on the bottom of the screen. If you have a Bible, you can turn to the first one in Deuteronomy chapter 30. Deuteronomy chapter 30. And what he says in chapter 30, I won't read the passage for the sake of time. In chapter 30, verses 1 and 2, he spells out a fact that no matter what the Jews may be living in the world, they'll all come to faith. And not only after they all come to faith, that verse 3 says that then Jehovah your God will turn your captivity, will have compassion upon you, return and gather you, multiple peoples whither God has gathered you. If any of the outcasts be in the outermost part of heaven, from thence will Jehovah your God gather you, from thence will he fetch you, and so on. But notice there is first of all a national salvation before there is this final regathering. And the modern Jewish state would not fulfill a prophecy like this. And then looking at Isaiah chapter 27, verses 12 and 13, in verse 12 he points out that in the final restoration, one by one, every Jew is brought back into the land of Israel. But in verse 13, it is then they are being motivated to return for the purpose of worshiping the Lord in the city of Jerusalem. Now, the motivation for the Zionist movement has been to provide for the Jewish people a place where they can be living in peace and living in security without constantly being threatened by anti-Semitism. So initially it was primarily a secular movement. Many of the Orthodox were opposed to it, but after the Holocaust, the main line of Orthodoxy did support Israel, only among the Hasids that there's still some opposition to this day because they feel that Israel cannot exist till the Messiah comes. And so the motivation that for the Jews to return for in Zionism was for safe haven for Jews, not for the purpose of worshiping the Lord in Jerusalem. That's the motivation here in Isaiah. Ezekiel chapter 39, verses 25 to 29 spells out that the final restoration is in connection with the outpouring of the Holy Spirit upon the whole people. And furthermore, with the final restoration, they'll be welcomed by the surrounding nations. This has not been true with the present Jewish state. They have not been welcomed by the surrounding nations. And there's been a couple of peace treaties, but it's been largely a cold peace and so on. And there's still many elements around the country that are in opposition to Israel. And so this is the modern Jewish state does not fulfill a prophecy like this. Now again, the second view says a day will come when these prophecies will be quite literally fulfilled. But the modern Jewish state does not fulfill these kind of prophecies. Therefore, it is an accident of history. The third view is the view that says what we are now seeing is the beginnings of Israel's final restoration. Bit by bit, God will bring all the Jews back into land. Some are in the process, they're not quite sure when there'll be a national salvation. And therefore, this is the beginnings of the final restoration. Therefore, it is necessary, incumbent, mandatory for every Jew to return to the land. And when you ask about the tribulation prophecies, they claim that the tribulation prophecies have been fulfilled with the Nazi Holocaust. And therefore, there is no future tribulation, and therefore it's now mandatory for all Jews to go back to land, and that includes Messianic Jews. And emissaries of this position go out to different segments of the Jewish world, telling them that it is incumbent upon them to return to Israel and to do so quickly. Because if they do not return to Israel, then they're living in sin. Now, we have established a large congregation in St. Petersburg, Russia, and emissaries of this view came into the St. Petersburg congregation telling the Jewish believers that if they stay in Russia, they'll still be lost. Believing in Jesus is a good thing, but that's not enough to save them. They must go back to Israel. So salvation is not merely what you believe, but also where you happen to be living, and so on. In the Messianic congregation I was a member of when I was still living in California, an emissary came telling the Jewish believers that they must go back to Israel right away or they'll be judged. And when the elders of the congregation asked him for biblical verification, he took him to Jeremiah 15:51, where God calls the Jewish people in Babylon to return to land. And the elders pointed out, it says Babylon. His answer was, when Jeremiah said Babylon, Babylon was merely a symbol of the USA. And I'm sure that would surprise Jeremiah as well. And when they pointed out, it talks about the Euphrates River. He went on to say, when Jeremiah said the Euphrates, it was a symbol for the Mississippi River. And therefore, it is now requirement, because what we are now seeing is the beginnings of Israel's final restoration. Now, what all these three first views miss is that the Bible speaks of two different worldwide regatherings. First of all, there is a worldwide regathering in unbelief, in preparation for judgment, which is the judgment of the tribulation. Then secondly, there'll be a second worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing, which is the blessings of the Messianic Kingdom. Now this is the third perspective I will try to prove by scripture. Number one, there is a worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. And a second worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing. The judgment will be the tribulation, the blessing will be the Messianic Kingdom. So we're going to focus now on the first worldwide regathering in unbelief and preparation for judgment. Tomorrow we shall talk about the second worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing. So now think in terms of 3 plus 1 plus 3. 3 plus 1 plus 3. The first three, we'll look at three passages to speak of a different kind of worldwide regathering than those we just looked at. The plus one, we'll look at another passage that will add some more detail and deal with the fourth perspective. And if time still allows, we'll deal with the last plus three so that you can deal with some three other issues involved with the modern Jewish state in Bible prophecy. The first passage, the first three, number one, Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 33 through 38. Again, to save time, I won't read these passages. But in this passage, he describes a worldwide regathering in unbelief. He draws a parallel with the Exodus. At the Exodus, God brought the whole nation out of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness of the Sinai Peninsula. And God's plan and program for Israel in the Sinai was to accomplish two things. First of all, they were to receive the Mosaic Law, and secondly, to build a tabernacle through which much of the law could then be maintained. And then with these two things accomplished, they were to press on and enter into the promised land itself. Because of a series of rebellions and actions against God, at the oasis of Kadesh Barnea, which is right on the border of the promised land, God entered into judgment with his people. The judgment was all those who came out of Egypt would now have to continue wandering for 40 years until all those who came out will die out, except for the two good spies and those below the age of 20. So 40 years later was a new nation, a nation that was born in the desert and not as slaves in Egypt, that could enter the land under Joshua. And that historical frame of reference now becomes the background for something future, but now Ezekiel says God will bring the nation together from all over the world. He emphasizes it's a gathering out of wrath and a gathering for wrath. The gathered out of wrath in verses 33 and 34, and the wrath out of which they were gathered is the wrath of the Holocaust. But then also gather for a future time of wrath, the wrath of the tribulation. And in the tribulation, they'll undergo a national salvation, and then they'll be ready for the final restoration. This passage describes, notice, a little bit different than the first three passages we mentioned earlier, a worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. The second passage focuses more upon Jerusalem in Ezekiel chapter 22, verses 17 through 22. And he pictures the Jewish people gathered into Jerusalem, but Jerusalem becomes a large melting pot. And it's a regathering unbelief because they're filled with the impurities of wood, tin, iron, brass, and so on. And the reason to bring them into this time of wrath, this time of judgment, is to purge them and bring them to national salvation, as so they'll finally come back to the Lord. But again, he describes a worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. And the third passage is Zephaniah chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Now, chapter 1 of Zephaniah, verses 14 through 18, describes a time called the Day of Jehovah, the Day of the Lord. That's the most common term in both Testaments, describing the tribulation. Our most common term today is tribulation, great tribulation, but the most common term in Scripture is the Day of Jehovah, the Day of the Lord. It's always a time of judgment just before the establishment of the Messianic Kingdom. And so in chapter 1 describes what a terrible time that will be. As we come to chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, he goes on to point out something has to come before the Day of the Lord could start, and that is a regathering of the Jewish people in shame, gathered in unbelief, not yet ashamed of their sin, and the purpose of regathering them in unbelief to bring them into judgment is for them to finally turn away from their unbelief, to come to recognize who the Messiah is indeed, and finally come to national faith. And so, once again, you have another passage describing a regard of unbelief in preparation for judgment. That's the three. Now we go to plus one. There's another one here that deals with the judgment, the regard in unbelief. I won't deal with this one. Now, the next passage, the plus one, is Isaiah chapter 4, Isaiah chapter 11, verse 11 through chapter 12, verse 6. Isaiah 11, 11 through chapter 12, verse 6. Now that passage describes the second worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing. Same as the first three passages we looked at. So how is this relevant to a discussion we're having right now? Let me bring in the fourth perspective. The fourth perspective recognizes there's two types of worldwide regatherings, one in unbelief, one in faith. Having recognized this, they go on to say we cannot be 100% sure that the modern state is a fulfillment of all those prophecies that speak about a worldwide regathering unbelief. And why not? Because in their perspective, you can have a worldwide regathering in unbelief followed by dispersion. Then another regathering in unbelief followed by dispersion. Another regathering followed by dispersion before we have the specific one that fulfills these prophecies. And therefore, it cannot be sure the modern Jewish state is a fulfillment of these prophecies. That's what Isaiah says cannot happen. Isaiah 11, verse 11 and 12 speaks of the worldwide regathering in faith, but he names it as the second one. The last worldwide regathering, the final worldwide regathering, is the second one. If the last one is the second one, how many more can you have before that one? Even with new math, only one. So the Bible is only for two worldwide regatherings, no more. So the present Jewish state needs to be the fulfillment of those prophecies that spoke of worldwide regathering unbelief. And this is not the final one. The final one is yet to come with the final restoration. So that's the plus one. Now we'll go to the plus three, corollary evidence. The first element is the start of the tribulation, and the key passage here is Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. He points out what will begin the 70th seven of Daniel. What begins the last 7 years, that the 7 years of tribulation? And it will not be the rapture of the church that will trigger the tribulation. The rapture will come sometime before the tribulation starts. We do not know when before. But the starting point is clearly the signing of a seven-year covenant between Israel and the Antichrist. It is the signing of that covenant that triggers the tribulation. Now, this presupposes two things will be in place. One is, one is not. What is not yet in place is that shows that the Antichrist must already be in high political authority before a Jewish state like Israel could sign a covenant of this nature, because sovereign states do not sign covenants with nobodies. So Antichrist has to be in high political authority before the tribulation starts. This is not yet in place. But the second is that this presupposes that there must be a Jewish state or a Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed. And this has been true as of 1948. So biblically, the rapture could have come before 1948. That was always imminent. But the tribulation could not have come before 1948. There was no Jewish state or Jewish government with a covenant like this could be signed. So this is another way the modern Jewish state fulfills Bible prophecy. There had to be a Jewish state to sign a covenant for the tribulation to start. A second passage on this, which for the sake of time won't elaborate, is Isaiah 28, verses 14 to 22. And this passage also speaks of the necessity of a covenant signed between Israel and the Antichrist for the tribulation to begin. And he points out that when the covenant is signed on earth in heaven, God issues a decree of destruction against the whole earth. A decree of destruction against the earth dwellers, to use a phrase from the previous session. So the presuppositions between these two passages, Antichrist is already in high political authority before the tribulation, and there is a Jewish state in place, which has only been true as of 1948. Now, the next issue is the third temple. What we know for certain is that by the midpoint of the tribulation, the temple is standing and functioning. That much we know for sure. That leaves us with two options when it will be rebuilt. It might be rebuilt in the first half of the tribulation, or it might be rebuilt even before the tribulation starts. That's as close as we can come with biblical data we have at the present time, either before the tribulation or it could be in the first half of the tribulation. But what all this presupposes is that by the time of the temple building, the Jews are in control of the temple compound. And this did not happen in 1948. Israel became a state in 1948, but Jerusalem was cut in two, and the biblical Jerusalem and the temple compound fell under Jordanian authority and remained under their authority for 19 years until the Six-Day War. Only in the Six-Day War did they finally able to gain mastery of the temple compound. Only then was it possible to begin building the temple. Now, since from early days as a believer, periodically I noticed rumors breaking out that the Jews are rebuilding the temple. And after the Six-Day War, when I came back to America, I was in Jerusalem during the war, and people began hearing in churches that the Israel has begun importing stones from Bedford, Indiana, to build a temple. If you ever been to Israel only for 1 or 2 days, you'll soon notice something. The last thing Israel will ever need to do is import rock from anywhere to build anything. There's a Talmudic story that when God made all the rocks in the world, he put them in two bags. He gave to one angel to spread it evenly around the world, which he did. When the second angel flew out, the bag ripped, and half the world's rocks fell into the land of Israel. And furthermore, even by rabbinic law, you can't have stones. You have to get the stones from the hill country of Judah. So there are no, at the moment of time, there is no building a temple, but three things are happening, which I can elaborate. But number one, there's one group, the Temple Mount Institute, that's making all the furnishings in the temple. A second group is training descendants of Aaron to do proper sacrifices. And a third group is trying to produce the perfect red heifer. As far as the Ark of the Covenant, there's a misconception among many believers that they have to have the Ark for the temple to function. That's not true. The second temple functioned for 6 centuries with no Ark. And so you don't have Jewish people looking for the Ark. You have Christians looking for the Ark because they feel God needs a bit of help to fulfill his prophecies. But there's nothing to indicate that they'll ever find the Ark of the Covenant or they'll survive the Babylon destruction, and the Ark is not essential for a temple to function. Now, I cannot go into details here, but then also they don't have the perfect red heifer yet, by the way. Now, last thing, I may go back to the time that allows, but the last thing is Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, which deals with the northern invasion of Israel. I won't discuss here the timing. Among our literalist groups, there's 5 different interpretations about the timing. I think we're going to focus on this passage insofar as it affects the modern Jewish state of Israel. Now, from Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 8 and verse 12, notice the time, the type of Israel it describes. A nation that's been regathered from all the nations around the world after escaping the sword, and the modern Jewish state has Jews that come from 90 different countries. They've been rebuilding the great cities that have been made desolate over for many centuries, get out of wrath in unbelief. And this has only been true as of 1948. It's not describing an Israel of ancient history. The kind of Israel describes here has only been true as of 1948. And so there was a necessity of a regathering unbelief before this invasion occurred, and now we have such a regathering, and that fulfills one prerequisite. But furthermore, in Ezekiel 38, verse 8, and chapter 39, verses 2 and 4, the place where the armies are destroyed is the mountains of Israel. The mountains of Israel is the central mountain range, beginning at the end, the south end of the Jezreel Valley. It runs the length of the country, peters out just north of Beersheba. In the cities, you have the many biblical cities like Dothan, Shechem, Samaria, Shiloh, Bethel, Ai, Ramah, Bethlehem, Hebron, Debir, and Jerusalem. And it's just only a short list. Now, from 1948 to 1967, the mountains of Israel were not in Israel. They were under Jordanian sovereignty. And the way the border ran is the border ran the furthest mountains, came down. It then cut into the mountains, cut Jerusalem in two and in half and out again, and then came around the south end of the mountains. So Jordan had 95% of the mountains. Israel only had 5% of the mountains. But as a result of the Six-Day War, that's when Israeli sovereignty fell over the whole mountains of Israel. That's what the newspapers referred to as the West Bank. And ever since then, the West Bank has been a political issue for Israel, remains a political issue to this very day. And this is where and we know from the passage that the enemy will penetrate Israeli defenses, enter the mountains of Israel, obviously heading for Jerusalem, before finally God intervenes for the massive destruction of all of the invaders. But at this part of the Six-Day War, the mountains of Israel falling under Israeli sovereignty is not the way the modern Jewish state fulfills Bible prophecy. So, as far as the present Jewish state is not a fulfillment of those prophecies that speak of a worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing. It is a fulfillment of those prophecies that speak of a worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. And as long as we see God fulfilling his promises to Israel, that should give us the encouragement that we, the body of the Messiah, are also recipients of certain divine promises not yet fulfilled. For God is faithful to fulfill his promises to Israel, he'll be faithful to fulfill his promises to us as well. Now, I skipped a number of things, but if you want to see the full on the Ariel table in the hallway, there is an Ariel table and there's also manuscripts that cover tonight's study, also tomorrow morning study. Do you have 2 or 3 minutes left or not? Let's get back to the red heifer. About 20, 25 years ago, as I was traveling, I heard news reports that they have the perfect red heifer. But the red heifer, to be kosher, has to be killed at 3 years old. It was not a sacrifice. Red was killed outside the temple compound, burned to ashes, because it was used for the purpose of cleansing corpse uncleanness. If you touch the corpse, you would be unclean for 7 days. In the 7 days, twice you would be sprinkled with water containing the ashes of the red heifer. By the time this one red heifer was 3 years old, they had about 10 different black hairs and white hairs. By rabbinic law, it cannot have more than 2 white hairs or 2 black hairs. So what happened was the Texas rancher had several perfect red heifers. He shipped them to Israel, and you would think that would solve the problem, except for another rabbinic restriction. For the red heifer to be kosher, to be the red heifer, it must be born in Israel. It cannot be born in Texas. It must be a Jewish cow. It cannot be a Gentile cow. I guess it must be a Holstein, not a Angus. So what they're trying to do with the red heifers he sent them is use generic engineering to try to produce the perfect red heifer. There's rumors they have done so, but these rumors have not been authenticated or propitiated yet, so we don't really know. We know at some point they'll succeed, but at this point we don't have that success just yet. Sila.
For more resources, visit faithalone.org.